wake up.
Sunday mornings, the irreverent Uncle Pete. With your Sunday morning soft start, 8 to 10 a.m.
You must wake up.
Uncle Pete will bring you a kinder, gentler radio wake-up call.
Come on, wake up.
That's Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m.
Wake up, love.
That soft starts Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m. Only on 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau.
Can you not see that little light up there? Where? There.
And now, the man who invented the 21st century, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to this week's fully independent, non-corporate radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. If you'd like to contact the show, please feel free to email us at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's all one long run-on word, and Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Up next will be a piece I bring you each and every week about this time. This Way Out is an LGBT and teen news magazine produced out of San Francisco. Following that, we'll be bringing you shorter pieces like Peak Oil Check-In, Corporate Watchdog Radio, and Workers Independent News, to name a few. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show. And as always, I'd like to say, thanks for listening.
Relax, just go with it.
Fama writes, as an Italian-American connected and adventuring into her heritage, and as a lesbian identifying with the unspoken passions of the past and also conveying the passions of her own life.
You get a wallet card to carry with your driver's license, and if you ever are hospitalized, they look at this card, they type numbers into the computer at the hospital, and they get the document right there on the screen, and there can't be any questions about who it is who's entitled to make medical decisions.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The UN okays more queer consultants. Sappho's legacy lives in a Sicilian sister's poetry, and the difference between marriage rights and family protections. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 26, 2008. Two more LGBT groups have been given consultative status by the United Nations Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC. COC Netherlands and the State Federation of Lesbians, Gays, Transsexuals, and Bisexuals of Spain will now be allowed, as non-governmental organizations or NGOs, to deliver oral and written reports at UN meetings and to organize events there. ECOSOC, consisting of 54 member states of the UN, grants consultative status after reviewing recommendations of its subsidiary body, the NGO Committee, which screens the applications. Among more than 3,000 such groups, only a handful of LGBT organizations have gained consultative status, often after the full ECOSOC overturned negative recommendations from its NGO committee, which is typically dominated by member countries hostile to LGBT rights. In recent years, ECOSOC has approved Danish, German, and Swedish LGBT organizations for consultative status, along with a group from the Canadian province of Quebec and the European branch of the International Lesbian and Gay Association. The U.S.-based International Wages Due Lesbians and the Australian-based Coalition of Activist Lesbians have each had consultative status at the UN for more than a decade. The NGO committee is scheduled to review several additional applications from LGBT groups at its next two sessions in January and May 2009.
Some 5,000 athletes from across Europe converged on Barcelona this week for the annual Eurogames, which were first held in 1992 in the Dutch capital of The Hague. More than 30,000 tourists were expected to attend the Olympic-style sporting event in the Spanish port city, which is open to competitors of all sexual orientations and gender identities. Organizers say it could boost the local economy by up to 30 million euros, almost 48 million U.S. dollars. The four-day event kicked off on July 24th in colorful opening ceremonies at the Palau Sant Jordi Indoor Sporting Arena, which also hosted events during the 1992 Summer Olympic Games. Athletes are competing in several venues around Barcelona in 28 different sports, including tennis, swimming, track and field, and basketball. But same-gender versions of ballroom dancing are also a competitive sport. Queer conferences and cultural events are also being held in conjunction with the sports competitions.
More than 120,000 people turned out for Vienna's 13th LGBT Pride Parade on July 12th. Organizers called for an end to discrimination in Austria and for marriage equality.
But an attorney for the family of a California gay man who died after being shot by police during an LGBT pride-related boat cruise in San Diego Harbor is planning to file state and federal civil rights lawsuits. Brian Claypool said the suits will accuse San Diego Harbor police and the two officers involved of excessive force, negligence, and civil rights violations. Harbor police were alerted by operators of the charter boat late in the evening on July 19th that a man had gone overboard. 37-year-old Stephen Paul Hirschfield of West Hollywood was rescued, but reportedly began fighting with officers. He allegedly grabbed a taser from one officer and hit him in the face, and then, police officials said, Hirschfield attempted to take the officer's handgun. As the two struggled, a second officer shot Hirschfield. He was pronounced dead by paramedics when the police boat docked. But family attorney Claypool said that autopsy results showed no evidence on Hirschfield's body that he had struggled with police prior to being shot and that he was not the aggressor. The way the officers handled the situation, he said, is consistent with individuals who have a bias or prejudice against gay people. A spokesperson for the Harbor Police said the department had no comment because it had not yet seen details of the lawsuit.
A judge ruled this week that 14-year-old Brandon McInerney, who's charged with the hate crime murder in February of 15-year-old fellow student Larry King in an Oxnard, California classroom, will be tried as an adult. He faces 50 years to life in prison. Several classmates have said King would wear feminine attire, sometimes flirting with and angering other boys at the school. He was shot in the head during a morning computer class. More than 20 other students were in the room at the time. McInerney was arrested shortly thereafter. His attorney fought to have the teen tried as a juvenile. A conviction in juvenile court would have allowed him to go free at age 25. A coalition of 27 LGBT rights groups had sided with McInerney's lawyer and called on the district attorney not to prosecute McInerney as an adult. But he will be formally arraigned as an adult on August 7th.
26-year-old physics student Ahmet Yildiz, dubbed Turkey's gay poster boy after he attended an international LGBT event in San Francisco last year, was shot to death late last week as he was leaving a cafe in Istanbul. He tried to escape his attackers in his car, but lost control, crashed at the side of the road, and died shortly afterwards in the hospital. Friends told reporters that he was a victim of Turkey's first gay honor killing. Women have until now been the only known victims of such murders, usually by male relatives, for offending chauvinistic conservative social traditions, so Yildiz's case may be unique. Friends speculate that he was targeted after coming out as a gay man earlier this year. "I never heard Ahmet have a friendly conversation with his parents," one close friend and neighbor told the London Independent newspaper. "They would argue constantly, mostly about where he was, who he was with, and what he was doing," he said. "They wanted him to see a doctor who could cure him and get married." Yildiz reportedly told a prosecutor 5 months ago that he had been receiving death threats, but no action was taken. His boyfriend, who held a German passport, left the country soon after the shooting on the advice of the consulate. Police claimed to be investigating the case. "He could have hidden who he was, but he wanted to live honestly," another friend told the newspaper. "When the death threats started, his boyfriend tried to persuade him to get out of Turkey, but he stayed. He was too brave."
Thousands of LGBT activists from across Australia protested Roman Catholic Pope Benedict XVI's visit to the country this week. He'd been in Australia as part of World Youth Day, a mass gathering of adherents aimed at encouraging them to celebrate their faith. As pilgrims march from Anzac Parade and Moore Park Road in Sydney on July 20th, thousands of protesters handed out condoms and waved placards along the route with slogans like, "Pope, go homo." It was mostly peaceful, although a Catholic man was arrested for allegedly punching one of the protesters. He was later released without charge. New South Wales police officials had originally banned protesters from attending World Youth Day events under the pretense that it was illegal to annoy the pilgrims. The Australian federal court rejected that assertion. Pope Benedict has since returned to Rome.
A U.S. House panel on July 23rd heard from five witnesses in the first-ever congressional hearing to consider the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The measure banning open gays and lesbians in the armed forces was adopted early in the Clinton administration. Three of those testifying advocated repeal of the policy, but two others charged that Don't Ask, Don't Tell wasn't strong enough to prevent gays and lesbians from enlisting. Captain Joan E. Dara, a retired naval intelligence officer who served for 29 years, and Staff Sergeant Eric Alva, a retired Marine who lost his leg as the first American injury of the Iraq War, testified about how the policy prevents qualified personnel from serving their country. Retired heterosexual Major General Vance Coleman, an African American who joined the Army in 1947, 1 year before President Harry Truman desegregated the military, also told the panel that, "I know what it's like to be treated like a second-class citizen." But Elaine Donnelly, president of the Center for Military Readiness, testified with what Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank described as an extraordinary exhibition of rage. She claimed that lesbians would take pictures of other service women while they were showering, warned of forcible sodomy, that gay men would spread HIV positivity through the ranks, and that repealing the policy would allow personnel to cross-dress. A member of the House panel, Democratic Representative Vic Snyder of Arkansas, called her statements just bonkers and dumb. Sergeant Major Brian Jones, a retired Army officer, warned that cramped wartime conditions often require skin-to-skin contact when soldiers must huddle to protect themselves from cold, a situation he argued in which arousal would be disastrous. While those testifying against repeal seem to generate more support in the committee for overturning Don't Ask, Don't Tell, most analysts say there's little chance that a congressional vote will come this year and that President Bush would likely veto a repeal measure if it passed.
And finally, a court in Athens has rejected a lawsuit spearheaded by a male resident of Lesbos demanding that the term lesbian should only be legal to describe those who live on the Greek island. The plaintiffs argued that Lesbos residents held sole claim to the word and that its use in the context of female sexuality disgraced them around the world. The suit also claimed that the name of the national LGBT group Homosexual and Lesbian Community of Greece insults the identity of the people of Lesbos. The island is a popular holiday destination, especially for lesbians, because it was home to the ancient poet Sappho, who passionately wrote about love between women. Several residents testified during the trial, in fact, that the use of the word lesbian had brought recognition to the island and boosted its tourist economy. The ruling not only threw out the lawsuit, the plaintiffs were also ordered to pay court costs. They told reporters, however, that they're considering an appeal.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 26, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm John Beaupre.
Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about one woman who uncovered the true nature of little-known cultures, and we'll hear from another woman who uncovers false assumptions about contemporary families. But first, her celebration of Italian-American and lesbian identity, Looking for Cover, poems by Maria Fama, includes a new look at an old favorite, Sappho. Fama explores the Sicilian roots of the poetess in exile. This Way Out correspondent Janet Mason explores The Explorer.
To read Maria Fama's poetry is to enter another world that is wrought in lush and sensuous detail. You will find a rich history filled with the common folk, the peasants, who have come to this country from Italy, where they struggled and dreamed, and in passing down the stories of their lives and hardship, they have made the writer, and by extension the reader, stronger and more appreciative of life's simple pleasures. Her most recent collection of poetry, Looking for Covers, Poems by Maria Fama, published by Bordighera Press in New York, is a study in identity. Fama writes, as an Italian-American connected and adventuring into her heritage, as a woman identifying the strengths often overlooked but inherent in the conventions and confinement of the lives of previous generations of women, and as a lesbian identifying with the unspoken passions of the past and also conveying the passions of her own life. Fama writes from these identities and of these identities from the subterranean fields of richly textured experience and not from labels. In some respects, the writing is ahead of its time, but also it is of its time and timeless. In this collection, we meet the Camari, the Italian word for a special bond between women that went beyond friends. One of these Camari, defined by Fama's wordplay as co-Marys and co-Marias, is Fama's aunt, Zia Angelina. Angelina and her special friend, her Camari, live two doors away from each other. Camare Angelina, Camare Maria, late afternoons they sipped and dipped, they sipped espresso, they dipped biscotti. In the late afternoon they sipped and dipped before the suppers and the husbands filled their homes. The two Camari mark their birthdays together, their name days, and Angelina searches the stores of South Philadelphia for the card that contains the sentiment that she has for her Camari. She searched high and low and was unable to find anything, so she bought a To My Husband card. She took the card home and with a black pen crossed out the word husband and wrote Camari. To my dear Camari. The words all fit. They fit, she knew they fit. She knew they fit her. Camare, Camare, Camare Maria. Angelina's Camare Maria. The poem, Camari, is from the section of the book called Under the Tent, Performance Poems, some of which are recorded in Maria's voice on a companion CD. This section also contains Fama's piece entitled simply Sappho. In this exploration of the great lesbian poetess, whose Greek name is invoked, Sappho, Fama sees her Italian grandmother's face on the face of a young, beautiful Greek woman dancing at the festival. She takes this experience and launches it into a journey of her connection, as a woman who loves women and as a woman whose line of descent can be traced back to Sicily, the place where the poetess Sappho once lived in exile. She writes of the connection between Greece and Italy, between her own history and Sappho's, and the Sicilian and Greek saying, one face, one race, in Italian, una faccia, una razza. Greek and Sicilian, Tyrrhenian, Ionian, Aegean seas, the deepest blue, black eyes and green seas, sapphire, sapphic seas. This collection is peopled with the living and the dead, the loved ones and ancestors that she keeps alive in her memories, writing, and conversations with friends. From the Camari to the Sicilian understanding of Sappho to the ancestors and loved ones who have passed, Fama invokes her culture in richly textured writing full of sensuous details, allowing us, as readers, to enter this subterranean world where everything is honored. And in experiencing and understanding this, we learn to honor ourselves just a little bit more. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer literature and life for This Way Out.
Margaret Mead, prominent American anthropologist, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Margaret Mead was born in Philadelphia in 1901. Entering adulthood, she felt urged to advance the understanding of human behavior. Studying anthropology at Barnard College, she met her mentor, Ruth Benedict. Their relationship would become the most intimate of Mead's life, lasting throughout her three marriages. Mead's field study in the South Pacific led to her bestseller, Coming of Age in Samoa. Her research of various cultures made her one of the first in the modern age to champion diversity. In a 1975 article for Red Book magazine, she asserted it was time to recognize bisexuality as a normal form of sexual expression. She feared that revealing her own bisexuality would close doors in her career. But she said everyone should be able to choose companionship with a member of their own or opposite sex, which certainly opened doors for the next generation. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Candace Kimbrick.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
The law has changed so that we have gender equality in marriage under the law. And I think that makes a lot of people think that the problems have been solved when, of course, they haven't been.
Last time on This Way Out, law professor Nancy Polakoff explained why she believes marriage equality is not the be-all and end-all of family rights. In this week's conclusion, correspondents Josie Catoggio and Melissa Chiprin ask the author of Beyond Straight and Gay Marriage, Valuing All Families Under the Law, about one particular case that crystallized the issue.
I wanted to talk about Sharon Kowalski.
I start the book with her because certainly all of us who lived through that remember it very clearly. So Sharon Kowalski was very severely injured in a car accident. She had a partner of 4 years, Karen Thompson. They were not out to Sharon's family. Really, they weren't out to very many people. And Karen arrives at the hospital, isn't allowed to see Sharon. That's the beginning of 10 years of struggle over who's going to control Sharon's welfare. And for most of that time, Sharon's father was her guardian. Karen, at one point, it was 3.5 years that Karen couldn't even visit Sharon or see her. It was a complete tragedy and disgrace. Sharon's care deteriorated greatly.
I mean, her parents put her in a place where she was not getting rehabilitative
exactly.
care, even though she had indicated that she wanted her partner to be her
well,
caretaker.
And that's why disability rights groups were also very involved in this case, because Sharon did have some ability to express what she wanted, and a series of judges just continually disregarded that on the theory that it wasn't reliable because of her disability. So there was quite a lot of political effort, but meanwhile, she did deteriorate. Now, ultimately, Karen did become her guardian. Karen was in a new relationship at that time, but she and her new partner brought Sharon back to their home, which Karen had completely fitted for Sharon's wheelchair, and the three of them continue to live together. Today, a family constellation that I think really challenges a lot of people's ideas about what a family is. That's why I argue so much that the law shouldn't be making these arbitrary limits. I mean, those three people do form a family together. And in order to keep those kinds of problems from happening, and I would also say I'm quite sympathetic to the same-sex couples who say they want to marry because they're terrified of what will happen if one of them's hospitalized.
Lover and I just had papers drawn up. I mean, that's what one does. You know, you do medical and legal powers of attorney.
Yes, you do that. But, you know, there are even examples of hospitals that have not honored those. And the answer is not marriage. I mean, that is so the wrong answer. First of all, one of the things I most surprised people with in the book is a study in Detroit of older married couples that showed that 50% of them didn't pick their spouses to be their medical power of attorney, so when they made them. So, you know, not everybody wants a spouse to do it. We need to make sure we have a way of facilitating what you and your partner did without having to go to lawyers. And there are actually states that do that very easily now. And I use Idaho as an example. There are some others. But, you know, people I know in Idaho who've gone to their primary care doctors, they actually get a little pamphlet saying, you know, fill out these forms, send them in to the Secretary of State's office. It goes into a database. You get a wallet card to carry with your driver's license. And if you ever are hospitalized, they look at this card. They type numbers into the computer at the hospital, and they get the document right there on the screen. And there can't be any questions about who it is who's entitled to make medical decisions. I'm hopeful that if enough states do this, we could get a national registry for these advanced healthcare directives, and it could become as easy as organ donation, or maybe even easier than organ donation, as a routine matter with no charge whatsoever for everybody to make clear who they want to make these decisions for them. Because you may have a partner, and the two of you may do this, but what about our single friends? They don't have a partner to do it with jointly, and certainly, of course, marriage is not anywhere near what's going to help them, but they should be equally entitled to make sure that their wishes about who makes decisions for them are recognized. So this is a very bad fit, the argument that we need to have marriage in order for same-sex couples to be able to have these medical protections. And so I do describe in the book the other ways to do it and the states that get it right. And really how silly the argument is, because unless those couples, even if they can marry, even if they're in Massachusetts, if they're never going to leave the state of Massachusetts, maybe they'll be okay. But if they travel outside the state, we've got more than half the states in this country that have constitutional amendments that ban same-sex marriage. I want everybody in those states to make sure the person they want makes their health care decisions. And I think we can accomplish this. Because if you take it out of the context of same-sex marriage, there's really universal agreement that you and I and everybody else should get to pick the person who makes those decisions. And we can bypass the politics of same-sex marriage and get this problem solved for everybody.
Nancy, this is Melissa. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier. Is there a time frame when you say, like, a couple would get the legal rights that say that a married couple have?
Well, in Canada, they actually do, for most things, have a time frame. Some of them involve living together for a year, and others involve living together for 3 years. And some of their court cases show that living together is a little bit loose, like you could actually have two homes and still be living together under some factual circumstances. So there is a time frame for some of these rights to kick in. But if you think about it, perhaps some of those rights, even for people who marry, where you have marriage, should take a while to kick in. New Zealand actually has a law where if they don't have children, when they're married for less than 3 years, when they get divorced, each person just takes their own stuff and goes away. Like, they don't have the whole regime of property division in marriage until after they've been married for 3 years. So, you know, that's a good example of how instantly when you marry, nothing's really changed in your life except that piece of paper. And instantly you're entitled to inherit, for example, from the other person. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that you can't disinherit your spouse, but you can disinherit your children. Like, how shocking is that? That if you've got some children with a former spouse, you can leave them absolutely nothing in your will, period. But your new spouse, that person you can't disinherit. I mean, it's completely backwards. Anyway, for some of the things that I talk about in the book, I think a durational requirement makes a certain amount of sense. But for other things, you know, you're just really looking at how the people function together. And duration may not have anything to do with that. Washington State right now will divide the property of a couple that lives together, married or unmarried, in the same exact way. And so they don't use a durational time, but, you know, if you're only married for a year, there's not going to be much community property to divide. And if you're only living together for a year, the same thing. There's not going to be much community property to divide. But Washington State is the one place in this country now where if you live your life as an intimate family unit and you separate, they don't care whether you got married or not.
We've been talking with Nancy Polakoff about her book, Beyond Straight and Gay Marriage, Valuing All Families Under the Law, published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
And our thanks to This Way Out correspondents Josie Catoggio and Melissa Chiprin. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Lee Moore, John Beaupre, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Candace Gingrich, and Josie Cotoggio and Martha Chiprin contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive weekly email alerts describing the content of each This Way Out, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KSLW Cottage Grove, Oregon, 2HOT Cobar, New South Wales, WOJB Hayward, Wisconsin, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We're all going to stay tuned.
This is 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
This is the Corporate Watchdog Radio headline news for the week of July 30th. Malaria drugs cheaper thanks to Clinton Foundation effort with some drug companies. New law bans Burmese gem imports. Pax World settles with SEC for violating its own social screening rules. And U.S. Army to cut its carbon bootprint. Malaria is the leading killer in Africa today. Affording malaria medication has always been a problem for African governments and their citizens. But the Clinton Foundation hopes to make the drugs cheaper and more available. It's just signed an agreement with several malaria drug suppliers to stabilize the medication's fluctuating costs and ensure a more dependable supply. The drug is artemisinin, a wormwood extract. Its price is extremely volatile, bouncing between a low of $155 to a high of $1,000 per kilo in recent years. In the agreement, the six suppliers will honor price ceilings the foundation says will keep prices constant. And two companies, Cipla and Ipca, have agreed to produce a new formulation of the drug for about 30% less than the prevailing market price. The Clinton Foundation hopes more suppliers will sign on to the agreement. On Tuesday, President George Bush signed a law barring imports of Burmese rubies and jade. The Tom Lantos Block Burmese Jade Act, named after the late Democratic representative who introduced the measure, tightens an existing ban on trade in Burmese gems. Arvind Ganasan, director of the Business and Human Rights Program at Human Rights Watch, welcomed the move.
Burmese gemstones are tainted with human rights abuses. The international trade in these gems helps finance repressions and puts millions into the pockets of Burma's abusive rulers. With the new law, U.S. retailers can no longer legally profit from the trade in Burmese rubies and jade.
Since 2003, the U.S. government has banned products from Burma, but a loophole allowed the purchase of gems from Burma that were cut or polished in third countries, such as India or Thailand. The new law eliminates this loophole for rubies and jade, by far Burma's top-selling gem exports. Contrary to some early reports, it does not cover other precious stones or forbid the sale of Burmese origin gems legally imported to the U.S. under prior rules. The new law also urges Chevron to consider divesting from a gas pipeline if Burma's military junta does not embrace reforms. Socially responsible investing firm Pax World settled with the SEC today over claims it violated its own social screens. 10 of the 41 unscreened securities held in the Pax World Growth Fund and the High Yield Fund from 2001 to 2005 actually failed Pax's social screens. What's more, Pax's social research department made an error in applying its weapons screen on one company, and it failed to report its screening mistakes to the fund's trustees properly. The settlement cites negligent conduct, but not intentional wrongdoing, and assesses a $500,000 civil penalty on Pax World, but not on fund shareholders. Could cutting greenhouse gas emissions also save the lives of soldiers in Iraq? The U.S. Army thinks so. Troops and convoys bringing gasoline to operations are often targets of insurgents. But the Army hopes its plans to limit the use of fossil fuels will also limit the attacks. In a move to reduce its carbon footprint, the Army aims to cut carbon emissions by 30% by the year 2015. Wind and solar energy would help supply power in forward operating bases in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other regions. It's all part of a wider sustainability plan the Army is putting into play and includes better insulated tents, lighter weight armor, and hybrid tanks and other vehicles. But this move raises the larger question of whether wars fuel climate change and whether the cost of waging wars limits resources for combating the climate crisis. For the Corporate Watchdog Radio Headline News, I'm Bill Bowie.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. On Thursday, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger cut 22,000 jobs and slashed the pay for 200,000 state workers down to the federal minimum wage, effective in September. The California Labor Federation's Jeremy Smith says the governor is wrong to lash out at workers and their livelihoods to try to resolve the state's budget problem.
Can't figure out why the governor thinks he should penalize them for the inability to get a budget passed.
IBEW members rallied Thursday at Verizon's Boston headquarters as a midnight Saturday strike deadline approaches. The highly profitable telecom giant could face a walkout by 70,000 workers. IBEW's Paul Feeney says the Communications Workers of America and the IBEW are working together to try to reach a new contract at Verizon. And Feeney says should a strike be necessary Saturday night, the IBEW will have plenty of support.
Workers really need to stick together. We're going to be reaching out to sympathetic organizations throughout the country. We're reaching out to many different labor unions through organizations like Jobs with Justice. There's a lot of people that we have that are ready to support us on Saturday night.
Millions of workers nationwide have no paid sick days. That includes 5.4 million in California, 40% of the state's workforce. California's Healthy Families, Healthy Workplaces Act would change that by requiring employers to provide 5 to 9 paid sick days per year for workers. A new report on the public health effects of this proposal shows it would improve public health in California. Dr. Rajiv Bhatta co-wrote the report.
Workers with paid sick days were more likely to go to doctors for preventative care, to take time off when sick, and to care for their own children when their children were sick. We were really struck by the fact that those with the greatest need for paid sick days had the least access. California workers in poor health and with chronic diseases like hypertension were less likely to have paid sick days.
Alicia Hershey is a San Francisco restaurant worker who sees the need for paid sick days firsthand.
When people are sick, we tend to come into work anyway because we need to make that money for that shift. So I know as a restaurant worker myself, I rarely take off sick time.
25,000 West Coast dock workers in the ILWU are taking a look now at details of the contract agreement reached between the union and the Pacific Maritime Association. They'll decide whether or not to ratify it. The union says the agreement meets the needs of workers and of the industry. Walmart managers and executives knew of widespread denial of breaks for its workers nationwide, but turned a blind eye to the practice, according to a judge quoted in the publication Arkansas Business. Megan Scott of WakeUpWalmart.com says the giant retailer faces more than 70 lawsuits nationwide for alleged labor violations.
Since 2005, they've lost all three of their wage and hour class action lawsuits that it's faced.
The AFL-CIO is reaching out to 600,000 union voters in the swing states of Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The Labor Federation is attempting to accurately define Senator Barack Obama to those voters. Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Eco Check-In. Exploring the end of the age of oil.
The U.S. Congress won't face unpleasant facts about the world energy situation, and as a result, it makes bad policy. The same thing is happening on the state level. Vermont's lone congressional representative, Democrat Peter Welch, is a case in point. Earlier this year, he introduced legislation to stop additions to the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which was at about 70% of its congressionally mandated capacity. He claimed that the oil the U.S. was buying to put aside for an emergency was driving up the worldwide price of oil, and his legislation put an end to filling the reserve until oil prices dropped to $50 a barrel. The legislation passed and was signed into law in early May, with the ceiling on oil prices raised to $75 a barrel in the final bill. What happened? I've never seen legislation fail so quickly and visibly before. On May 16th, the U.S. Department of Energy announced that it would not sign contracts to add more oil to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Additions would end in July, after existing contracts expired. Oil closed that Friday at about $120 per barrel, up $5 from the previous week. By the following Wednesday, the price of July futures had jumped to a new record of over $134 per barrel. So much for Welch's hope of lowering oil prices. Peter Welch is at it again. He says that today's high oil prices constitute an emergency, so he calls on George W. Bush to release oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve because, he says, that would trigger a drop in oil prices. He's a slow learner, isn't he? One thing I agree with Welch about. We're in an emergency. It looks like the beginning of what James Howard Kunstler calls the long emergency. As world oil production declines after peak oil, climate change kicks in with vigor, and other chickens come home to roost. If we are beginning a long emergency that lasts for decades, it hardly seems a propitious time to tap an emergency reserve that could be sucked dry in 2 years. In the last few years, demand for oil has increased and world oil production has been flat. You'd think that this fact would figure prominently in any discussion of why fuel prices are high, wouldn't you? Increasing demand and stagnant supply mean higher prices in any commodity, whether it's oil or milk or gold. How is it, then, that so many in Congress, like Peter Welch, can speak or write at length about energy and prices without once mentioning the basics of supply and demand? Instead, we see vainglorious proposals like tapping the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or finger-pointing at speculators, as Welch, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, and many others in Congress are doing. The same sort of confusion about causes of high fuel prices is evident at the state level, too. I recently attended a press conference in which representatives of Vermont's Republican administration and its majority Democratic legislature sat side by side and explained their joint proposals for addressing this winter's food, fuel, and transportation emergency. At the end of an hour and a half press conference, I asked, "What's going on here? How come oil prices are so high anyway?" They all looked flustered, and the senator said, "It's something we could discuss over a beer, maybe." Someone else said they probably all had different opinions on it. They were united on solutions for a problem that they didn't agree on the definition of. That's like agreeing on the make and model of the car you're going to rent, without agreeing on where you're going to drive it. You can only get so far before agreement breaks down. The chair of the House Appropriations Committee told me, "What does it matter what the cause is, as long as we know Vermont can't affect it?" Well, if you think that Congress can pass some legislation and drop prices, you'll think about doing things differently than if you think that oil prices are likely to continue climbing and the economy, built on cheap energy, is likely to continue unraveling. For example, one of the proposals Vermont's leaders are suggesting is to help homeowners sell equity in their homes so they can buy oil this winter and burn it to keep warm. If the current prices are a blip, that might make some sense. If the homeowners are likely to be in worse financial shape a year from now, and oil prices are even higher then, I don't see that it serves homeowners at all. The Washington Post is finally tackling the story of peak oil. They're not approaching it with the journalistic rigor that they could, but at least it's receiving front-page attention in a paper read in every congressional office. Maybe that will give folks in Congress the courage to talk about oil supply and demand. And maybe the new habit from Washington will trickle down into the states. For now, I'm afraid there's still a lot of denial and wishful thinking about energy futures in our nation's leaders. I'm Carl Ettinger, And that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Eggplants, my entire life I have been enticed by your beauty and saddened by your utter lack of deliciousness. Your leathery skin, your spongy interior, you just don't appeal to me, eggplant. But then a year ago, a reader clued me into the secret of making eggplant good, dare I say, even delicious. Choose eggplants which are about fist size or smaller. They should be very shiny, have tight skin, be brightly colored, and feel heavy for their size. The only thing you need to prepare delicious eggplant is a good heat source. A nice hot oven or a grill will both work nicely. Place the whole eggplants in an oven-proof pan right on the coals of your grill or in the bottom of a hot oven. The general rule is to let them hang out while you get on cooking whatever else you're having for dinner. The skin will darken, maybe even turn black and blister, but it's okay. The eggplants will take about 20 minutes to an hour depending on their size, and you'll know they're done when you push on them with a spoon and they feel completely soft within. Carefully place them on a plate. Beware because they contain a lot of hot steam inside. Give the skin a slice and then just sort of push the flesh out from the center. It should be very soft and should not retain its shape. It should just kind of sigh and relax out of the skin. Give it a really generous drizzle of good extra virgin olive oil and sprinkle it with salt and pepper. This amazingly simple preparation will change how you feel about eggplant. And if you have any leftovers, you can chop them up very finely and add a little lemon juice. Tonight's eggplant side dish is tomorrow's baba ganoush. Eggplant, while not the nutritional powerhouse of some of its vegetal cousins, does contain pretty decent amounts of fiber, potassium, and a few B vitamins. It also is very low in calories, a mere 27 calories per cup, so you don't have to think twice about adding all that yummy extra virgin olive oil. Farmers markets will have eggplants till the end of the summer. Just try this method. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised, if not even amazed, as I was. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS LPFM 102.1 or 98.3 Columbus Community Radio. For the special offer, guaranteed personality.
And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.
Up next, we are going to bring you international flavored news never reported in the United States early this week, with an edited report about the apartheid wall in Palestine and the Canadian businesses trying to profit from these illegal settlements in violation of international law. Add that to the top of the hour will be more music of love, rage, and resistance. Thanks for tuning in to this Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6. Thanks for listening.
On July 9th, the village of Belin, located just north of Ramallah in the west bank of occupied Palestine, filed a lawsuit at the Quebec Superior Court against two Canadian companies. The rural village of around 1,700 inhabitants claims that Green Park and Green Mount, both companies which are registered in Montreal, are breaking international and Canadian law by financing and building Israeli settlements on the village's land. Israeli settlements are illegal under international law, as the Geneva Convention prohibits an occupying power from transferring civilian members of their population onto territories which they are occupying. As a result of the illegal settlements being built on Belin's land, Israel has built its famous apartheid wall right through the olive groves of the village, hence separating them from one of their main sources of agricultural revenue. Every Friday for the last 3 years, villagers of Belin, along with international and Israeli activists, have been holding demonstrations against the wall. Last week's lawsuit against Green Park and Green Mount is the newest step in this village's courageous resistance to Israeli apartheid. Next, we spoke with Mark Arnold on the phone from Toronto. Arnold is the lawyer who is representing the village of Belin in Canada. He explained some of the details surrounding Canadian and international law as they relate to Green Park and Green Mount's activities in the occupied West Bank of Palestine.
Could you just explain a little bit the content of this lawsuit for our listeners?
Right. Of course, acting for the village of Baleen, it is their claim that upon their lands, which is located on the West Bank, occupied Palestinian territories, two Canadian companies, one called Green Park International Incorporated, the other called Green Mount International Incorporated, are illegally building apartment buildings and condominium buildings, essentially at the behest of the State of Israel, for the purpose of providing housing accommodation to the population of Israel and replacing the population of Baleen from their land.
Okay, and as I understand it, this lawsuit, it's basically looking at international law, but also Canadian law. So maybe if you could just talk about some of the different laws that we're looking at and how those might apply to the case.
Yes, the laws all simply boil down to one point, and that is that in a document called the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is a 1949 international law, it was determined that an occupying power, a power that occupies land as a result of war, is prohibited from transferring its population onto the land and transporting the indigenous population away from that land. That's what international law says. Canadian law, specifically the Geneva Conventions Act and the War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanities Act, both of which are Canadian law, have brought into the laws of Canada that precise principle.
Has a lawsuit like this ever been tried before in Canada?
Not to my knowledge. This is an unprecedented case in Canadian jurisprudence.
Do you think there's a good chance that the Quebec court will hear it?
I'm not about to speculate as to what any court might do. I've been in the practice of civil litigation for many years. I'm a specialist in this area, and one can never predict what a court might do. I can say that my client is optimistic, and so am I.
Okay. And finally, what kind of a precedent do you think that this could set? I mean, if it was in fact decided in favor of the villagers of Baleen.
Yes, well, the point of it is this. The Canadian law basically says that if you do that wrong in a foreign country, Canadian law can reach you there. And so the precedent would be, if we were successful, to basically prohibit other Canadians, both individuals and companies, from violating international law and Canadian law, both in Canada and abroad. So that's the precedent that it would have.
And then what would be the legal process if this suit was won here in the Quebec court? What would be the process after that in terms of applying that to what's happening in Israel and Palestine?
Right. The Canadian court order, or we would call it a judgment, would only have application in Quebec and in Canada. What would happen is we would have to take that Canadian court order to the Israeli court and would simply say to that court, you don't need to look behind the order. In other words, you don't need to have another hearing on the issue. We would simply say to the Israeli court, recognize the Canadian court order and apply it in Israel. That, by the way, is also unprecedented under Israeli law.
Throughout the world, Palestinians are marking 2008 as the 60th anniversary of the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, when three-quarters of the Palestinian population were forced to flee their homes in 1948 with the creation of the State of Israel. We had a chance to speak again with Abdullah Abu Rameh in Baleen during one of their Friday demonstrations. The sounds you will hear in the background are rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas canisters fired by the Israeli army, as Abdullah spoke with us about the significance of the Nakba and the struggle against the apartheid wall.
You see, this is the second, another Nakba for us, for when they built the wall, the settlement. Hello? Hello? Hi, Adar. Hi, how? For us, about the checkpoints, wall, settlement, the people in the jail, what's going on to destroy our life, Well, it's what we call a second Nakba for us in
all Palestine. And what's going in Gaza every day, many people, children, women,
old men is killed in Gaza. Mm.
How many people have been injured or been put in jail here in Berlin?
From the beginning until now, 1,000 youngs injured from the beginning. Some of the youngs, they injured 10 or 20 times in this action. Around 60% from the village arrested from the beginning until now.
Wow. 1,000 young people from
injured.
Berlin.
Injured.
Wow. Injured. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Not all of them from Berlin, but I told some of, yani like me, 10, like Muhammad 20, like I 10 times. Because all of them, the number of people is 1,700. And not all of them coming because we have children, we have. But we talk about some of the people injured 10 times.
Okay.
And about arrested people, around 60% arrested, yes.
Okay. Is anyone still in jail?
Until now, thanks for God, all of them free and all of them in their homes.
This report was produced for CKUT Radio by Aaron Lakoff and Meg Leotold. For more information about Berlin's lawsuit and other campaigns against Israeli apartheid, visit the Tadaman Montreal website at tadaman.resist.ca.
is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
I'm with another gentleman here who's at the anti-Nazi protests. And I
this is Mike Cannon. I'm with Becca, who has returned from Palestine for the fourth time.
I'm with a vendor at the energy fair here who has biodiesel.
This is Mike Cannon. I'm with a group, the RNC Welcoming Committee for the Republican National Convention that's going to be coming up.
Need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So
stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And you too can stay current by checking out the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m. on this, your only not-for-profit, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.